all pumped up and she's ready to teach school. "Let me tell you something, honey," she goes. "A little drool in your slipper is very minor stuff. You men slay me. Try being a woman sometimes, okay? Try always being the one that ends up laying with the small of your back in that cum spot. Or the one that goes to the toilet in the middle of the night and the guy's left the goddamn ring up and you splash your can right down into this cold water. A little midnight skin diving. The toilet probably hasn't been flushed either. Men think the urine fairy comes around 2 a.m. They think the urine fairy comes around 2 a.m. and takes care of that. And there you are, sitting crack deep in piss. And all at once you realize your feet are in it too. You're paddling around in lemon squirt because although guys think they're dead-eyed dick with that thing, most can't shoot for shit. Drunk or sober, they gotta wash the goddamn floor all around the toilet before they can even start the main event. All my life I've been living with this, honey. A father, four brothers, one ex-husband, plus a few roommates that are none of your business at this late date. And you're ready to send poor Frank off to the gas factory because one time he happened to reflux a little drool into your slipper. My fur-lined slipper, I tell her, but it's just a little shot back over my shoulder. One thing about living with Lulu, and maybe to my credit, I always knew when I was beat. When I lost it, it was fucking decisive. One thing I certainly wasn't going to tell her was, even though I knew it for a fact, that the dog that puked in my slipper on purpose, the same way that he peed on my underwear on purpose, if I forgot to put it in the hamper before I went off to work. She can leave her bras and pants scattered around from hell to Harvard, and did. But if I left so much as a pair of athletic socks in the corner, I'd come home and find that jack shit terrier had given it a lemonade shower. But tell her that, she would have been booking me time with a psychiatrist. She would have been doing that even though she knew it was true. Because then she might have to take the stuff seriously, and she didn't want to. She loved Frank, you see. And Frank loved her. They were like Romeo and Juliet or Rocky and Adrian. Frank would come to her chair when we were watching TV. He'd lie down on the floor beside her and put his muzzle on her shoe. Just lie there all night like that, looking up at her, all soulful and loving, with his little butt pointed in my direction. So if he should have to blow a little gas, I'd get the full benefit of it. He loved her and she loved him. Why? Christ knows. Love's a mystery to everyone except the poets, I guess, and nobody sane can understand a thing they say about it. I don't think most of them can understand it themselves on the rare occasions when they wake up and smell the coffee. But Lulu Bell never gave me that dog so she could have it. Let's get that one thing straight. I know that some people do stuff like that. A guy will give his wife a trip to Miami because he wants to go there. Or a wife will give her husband a Nordic track because she thinks he ought to do something about his gut. But this wasn't that kind of deal. We were crazy in love with each other at the beginning. I know I was with her, and I'd stake my life that she was with me. No, she bought that dog for me because I always laughed so hard at the one on Frasier. She wanted to make me happy, that's all. She didn't know Frank was going to take a shine to her. Or her to him, no more than she knew the dog was going to dislike me so much that throwing up in one of my slippers and chewing the bottoms of the curtains on my side of the bed would be the high point of its day. LT wouldn't look around at the grinning men, not grinning himself, but he'd give his eyes that knowing, long-suffering roll, and they'd laugh again in anticipation. Me too, likely as not, in spite of what I knew about the axe man. "I haven't ever been hated before," he'd say. "Not by man or beast, and it unsettled me a lot. It unsettled me big time." I tried to make friends with Frank, first for my sake, then for the sake of her who gave him to me, but it didn't work. For all I know, he might have tried to make friends with me, with a dog, who can tell? And if he did, it didn't work for him either. Since then I've read, in Dear Abby, I think it was, that a pet is just about the worst present you can give a person, and I agree. I mean, even if you like the animal and the animal likes you, think about what that kind of gift says. Say, darling, I'm giving you this wonderful present. It's a machine that eats at one end and shits out the other, and it's going to be with you for 15 years, give or take. Merry fucking Christmas. But that's the kind of thing you only think about after, more often than not. You know what I mean? I think we tried to do our best, Frank and I. After all, even though we hated each other's guts, we both loved Lulu Bell. That's why I think that although he'd sometimes growl at me if I sat down next to her on the couch during Murphy Brown or a movie or something, he never actually bit. Still, it used to drive me crazy. Just the nerve of it, that little bag of hair and eyes daring to growl at me. Listen to him, I'd say. He's growling at me. She'd stroke his head the way she hardly ever stroked mine, unless she'd had a few, and say it was really just the dog's version of purring. That he was just happy to be with us, having a quiet evening at home. I'll tell you something, though. I never tried patting him when she wasn't around. I'd feed him sometimes, and I never gave him a kick, although if I didn't say I was tempted a few times, I'd be a liar. But I never tried patting him. I think he would have snapped at me, and then we would have gotten into it. Like two guys living with the same pretty girl, almost. Menage a trois is what they call it in the penthouse forum. Both of us love her, and she loves both of us, but as time goes by, I start realizing that the scales are tipping, and she's starting to love Frank a little more than me. Maybe because Frank never talks back and never pukes in her slippers. And with Frank, the goddamn toilet ring is never an issue, because he goes outside. Unless, that is, I forget and leave a pair of my undershorts in the corner or under the bed. At this point, LT would likely finish off the iced coffee in his thermos, crack his knuckles, or both. It was his way of saying that the first act was over and act two was about to commence. So then, one day, Saturday, Lulu and I are out at the mall, just walking around, you know, the way people do, you know, and we go by the Pet Notions up by JCPenney, and there's a whole crowd of people up in the display window. Oh, let's see, Lulu says. So we go over to the display window and we work our way to the front. It's a fake tree with bare branches and fake grass, astroturf, all around it. And there are these Siamese kittens, half a dozen of them, chasing each other around, climbing the tree, batting each other's ears. Oh, ain't they just the cutest ones, Lulu says. Oh, ain't they just the cutest little babies. Yook, honey, yook. I'm looking, I says. And what I'm thinking is that I just found what I wanted to get Lulu for our anniversary. And that was a relief. I wanted it to be something extra special, something that would really bowl her over, because things had been quite a bit short of great between us during the last year. I thought about Frank, but I wasn't too worried about him. Cats and dogs always fight in the cartoons, but in real life, they usually get along. That's been my experience. They usually get along better than people do, especially when it's cold outside. To make a long story just a little bit shorter, I bought one of them and gave it to her for our anniversary, got it a velvet collar and tucked a little card underneath it. Hello, I am Lucy, the card said. I come with love from LT. Happy second anniversary. You probably know what I'm going to tell you now, don't you? Sure. It was like goddamn Frank the Terrier all over again, only in reverse. At first, I was as happy as a pig in shit with Frank, and Lulu Bell was as happy as a pig in shit with Lucy. Held her up over her head, talking that baby talk to her. Oh, yook at you. Oh, yook at you, my widow precious. Oh, she's so cute. And on, until Lucy let out a yowl and batted the end of Lulu Bell's nose, with her claws out, too. Then she ran away and hid under the kitchen table. Lulu laughed it off like it was the funniest thing she'd ever had happen to her, and just as cute as anything else a little kitten might do, but I could see she was miffed. Right then, Frank came in. He'd been sleeping up in our room at the foot of her side of the bed, but Lulu let out a little shriek when the kitten batted her nose, so he came down to see what the fuss was about. He spotted Lucy under the table right away and walked toward her, sniffing the linoleum where she'd been. Stop them, honey. Stop them, LT. They're going to get into it, Lulu Bell says. Frank'll kill her. Just let them alone a minute, I say. See what happens. Lucy humped up her back the way cats do, but stood her ground and watched them come. Lulu started forward, wanting to get in between them in spite of what I'd said. Listening up wasn't exactly one of Lulu's strong points, but I took her wrist and held her back. It's best to let them work it out between them if you can. Always best. It's quicker. Well, Frank got to the edge of the table, poked his nose under, and started this low rumbling way in the back of his throat. Let me go, LT. I gotta get to her, Lulu Bell says. Frank's growling at her. No, he's not, I say. He's just purring. I recognize it from all the times he's purred at me. She gave me a look that just about would have boiled water, but she didn't say anything. The only times in the 3 years we were married that I got in the last words, it was always about Frank and Screw Lucy, strange but true. Any other subject, Lulu could talk rings around me, but when it came to the pets, it seemed as though she were always fresh out of comebacks. Used to drive her crazy. Frank poked his nose under the table a little further, and Lucy batted at his nose the way she batted at Lulu Bell's, only when she batted at Frank, she did it without popping her claws. I had an idea Frank would go for her, but he didn't. He just kind of woofed and turned away. Not scared, but more like he's thinking, oh, okay, so that's what that's about. Went back into the living room and laid down in front of the TV. And that was all the confrontation there ever was between them. They divvied up the territory pretty much the way that Lulu and I divvied up that last year we spent together when things were getting bad. The bedroom belonged to Frank and Lulu. The kitchen belonged to me and Lucy. Only by Christmas, Lulu Bell was calling her Screw Lucy, and the living room was neutral territory. The four of us spent a lot of evenings there that last year. Screw Lucy on my lap, Frank with his muzzle on Lulu's shoe, us humans on the couch, Lulu Bell reading a book, and me watching Wheel of Fortune or Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, which Lulu Bell always called Lifestyles of the Rich and Topless. The cat wouldn't have anything to do with her. Not from that day one. Frank, every now and then, you could get the idea that Frank was at least trying to get along with me. His nature would always get the better of him in the end, and he'd chew up one of my sneakers or take another leak on my underwear. But every now and then, it did seem as though he were putting forth an effort. Lap my hand or maybe give me a grin, usually if I had a plate of something he wanted a little of, though. Cats are different, though. A cat won't curry favor, even if it's in their best interest to do so. A cat can't be a hypocrite. If more preachers were like cats, this would be a religious country again. If a cat likes you, you know. If she don't, you know that too. Screw Lucy never liked Lulu, not one whit, and she made it clear from the start. If I was getting ready to feed her, Lucy would rub around my legs, purring, while I spooned it up and dumped it in her dish. If Lulu fed her, Lucy would sit all the way across the kitchen, in front of the fridge, watching her, and wouldn't go to the dish until Lulu had cleared off. It drove Lulu crazy. "That cat thinks she's the Queen of Sheba," she'd say. By then she'd given up the baby talk. Given up picking Lucy up, too. If she did, she'd get a wrist scratch more often than not. Now, I tried to pretend I liked Frank, and Lulu tried to pretend she liked Lucy, but Lulu gave up pretending a lot sooner than I did. I guess maybe neither one of them, the cat or the woman, could stand being a hypocrite. I don't think Lucy was the only reason Lulu left. Hell, I know it wasn't. But I'm sure Lucy helped Lulu Bell make her final decision. Pets can live a long time, you know. So the present I got for our second was really the straw that broke the camel's back. Tell that to dear Abby. The cat's talking was maybe the worst as far as Lulu was concerned. She couldn't stand it. One night, Lulu Bell says to me, "If that cat doesn't stop yowling, LT, I think I'm going to hit it with an encyclopedia." "That's not yowling," I said. "That's chatting." "Well," Lulu says, "I wish it would stop chatting." And right about then, Lucy jumped into my lap, and she did shut up. She always did, except for a little low purring way back in her throat, purring that really was purring. I scratched between her ears like she likes, and I happened to look up. Lulu turned her eyes back on her book, but before she did, what I saw was real hate. Not for me, for Screw Lucy. Throw an encyclopedia at it. She looked like she liked to stick the cat between two encyclopedias and just kind of clap it to death. Sometimes Lulu would come into the kitchen and catch the cat up on the table and swat it off. I asked her once if she'd ever seen me swat Frank off the bed that way. He'd get up on it, you know, always on her side and leave these nasty tangles of white hair. When I said that, Lulu gave me a kind of grin. Her teeth were showing anyway. If you ever tried, you'd find yourself a finger or three shy, more likely, she says. Sometimes Lucy really was Screw Lucy. Cats are moody, and sometimes they get manic. Anybody who's ever had one will tell you that. Their eyes get big and kind of glary. Their tails bush out. They go racing around the house. Sometimes they'll rear right back up on their back legs and prance, boxing at the air like they're fighting something that they can see, but human beings can't. Lucy got into a mood like that one night when she was about a year old. Couldn't have been more than 3 weeks from the day when I come home and found that Lulu Bell was gone. Anyway, Lucy came racing in from the kitchen, did a kind of racing slide on the wood floor, jumped over Frank, went skittering up the living room drapes, paw over paw. Left some pretty good holes in them with threads hanging down. Then she just perched on the top of the rod, staring around the room with her blue eyes all big and wild and the tip of her tail snapping back and forth. Frank only jumped a little and then put his muzzle back on Lulu Bell's shoe, but the cat scared the hell out of Lulu Bell, who was deep in her book, and when she looked up at the cat, I could see that outright hate in her eyes again. All right, she said, that's enough. Everybody out of the goddamn pool. We're going to find a good home for that little blue-eyed bitch. And if we're not smart enough to find a home for a purebred Siamese, we're going to take her to the animal shelter. I've had enough. What do you mean? I asked her. Are you blind? She asks. Look what she did to my drapes. They're full of holes. You want to see drapes with holes in them, I say. Why don't you go upstairs and look at the ones on my side of the bed? The bottoms are all ragged because he chews them. That's different, she says, glaring at me. That's different, and you know it. Well, I wasn't going to let that lie. No way was I going to let that one lie. The only reason you think it's different is because you like the dog and you don't like the cat I gave you, I says. But I'll tell you one thing, Mrs. DeWitt. You take the cat to the animal shelter for clawing the drapes on Tuesday. I can guarantee I'll take the dog to the animal shelter for chewing the bedroom drapes on Wednesday. You got that? She looked at me and started to cry. She threw her book at me and called me a bastard. A mean bastard. I tried to grab hold of her, make her stay long enough for me to at least try to make up. If there was a way to make up without backing down, which I wasn't going to do that time. But she pulled her arm out of my hand and ran out of the room. Frank ran after her. They went upstairs and the bedroom door slammed. I gave her half an hour or so to cool off, and then I went upstairs myself. The bedroom door was still shut, and when I started to open it, I was pushing against Frank. I could move him, but it was slow work with him sliding across the floor, and also noisy work. He was growling, and I mean growling, my friends. That was no fucking purr. If I'd gone in there, he would have tried his solemn best to bite my manhood off. I slept on the couch that night, first time. A month later, give or take, she was gone. If LT had timed his story right, most times he did, practice makes perfect, the bell signaling back to work at the W.S. Hepperton processed meat plants of Ames, Iowa would ring just about then, sparing him any questions from the new men, the old hands knew, and knew better than to ask, about whether or not LT and Lulu Bell had reconciled, or if he knew where she was today, or the all-time $64,000 question, if she and Frank were still together. There's nothing like the back-to-work bell to close off life's more embarrassing questions. Well, LT would say, putting away his thermos and then standing up and giving a stretch, it all led me to create what I call LT's theory of pets. They'd look at him expectantly, just as I had the first time I had heard him use that grand phrase, but they would always end up feeling let down, just as I always had. A story that good deserved a better punchline, but LTs never changed. If your dog and cat are getting along better than you and your wife, he'd say, you better expect to come home some night and find a Dear John note on your refrigerator door. He told that story a lot, as I've said, and one night when he came to my house for dinner, he told it to my wife and my wife's sister. My wife invited Holly, who had been divorced almost 2 years, so the boys and the girls would balance up. I'm sure that's all it was, because Rosalind never liked L.T. DeWitt. Most people do. Most people take to him like hands take to warm water. But Rosalind has never been most people. She didn't like the story of the note on the fridge or the pets either. I could tell she didn't, although she chuckled in the right places. Holly. Shit, I don't know. I've never been able to tell what that girl's thinking. Mostly just sits there with her hands in her lap, smiling like Mona Lisa. It was my fault that time, though, and I admit it. LT didn't want to tell it, but I kind of egged him on because it was so quiet around the dinner table, just the click of silverware and the clink of glasses, and I could almost feel my wife disliking LT. It seemed to be coming off her in waves. And if LT had been able to feel that little Jack Russell Terrier disliking him, he probably would be able to feel my wife doing the same. That's what I figured anyhow. So he told it, mostly to please me, I suppose, and he rolled his eyeballs in all the right places as if saying, gosh, she fooled me right good and proper, didn't she? And my wife chuckled here and there. She sounded as phony to me as Monopoly money looks, and Holly smiled her little Mona Lisa smile with her eyes downcast. Otherwise, the dinner went off all right, and when it was over, LT told Rosalind that he thanked her for a sportin' fine meal, whatever that is, and she told him to come any time. She and I liked to see his face in the place. That was a lie on her part, but I doubt there was ever a dinner party in the history of the world where a few lies weren't told. So it went off all right, at least until I was driving him home. LT started to talk about how it would be a year. Lulu Bell had been gone in just another week or so. Their fourth anniversary, which is flowers if you're old-fashioned, and electrical appliances if you're newfangled. Then he said is how Lulu Bell's mother, at whose house Lulu Bell had never shown up, was going to put up a marker with Lulu Bell's name on it at the local cemetery. Mrs. Sims says we have to consider her as one dead, LT said. And then he began to bawl. I was so shocked, I nearly ran off the goddamn road. He cried so hard that when I was done being shocked, I began to be afraid all that pent-up grief might kill him with a stroke or a burst blood vessel or something. He rocked back and forth in the seat and slammed his open hands down on the dashboard. It was like there was a twister loose inside him. Finally, I pulled over to the side of the road and began patting his shoulder. I could feel the heat of his skin right through his shirt, so hot it was baking. Come on, LT, I said. That's enough. I just miss her, he said in a voice so thick with tears I could barely understand what he was saying. Just so goddamn much. I come home and there's no one there but the cat, crying and crying, and pretty soon I'm crying too. Both of us crying while I fill up her dish with that goddamn muck she eats. He turned his flushed, streaming face full on me. Looking back into it was almost more than I could take, but I did take it. I had to take it. Who had gotten him telling the story about Lucy and Frank and the note on the refrigerator that night after all? It hadn't been Mike Wallace or Dan Rather, that was for sure. So I looked back at him. I didn't quite dare hug him in case that twister should somehow jump from him to me, but I kept patting his arm. I think she's alive somewhere. That's what I think, he said. His voice was still thick and wavery, but there was a kind of pitiful, weak defiance in it as well. He wasn't telling me what he believed, but what he wished he could believe. I'm pretty sure of that. Well, I said, you can believe that. No law against it, is there? And it isn't as though they found her body or anything. I like to think of her out there in Nevada, singing in some little casino hotel, he said. Not in Vegas or Reno. She couldn't make it in one of the big towns, but in Winnemucca or Ely, I'm pretty sure she could get by, someplace like that. She just saw a singer wanted sign and gave up her idea of going home to her mother. Hell, the two of them never got on worth a shit anyway. That's what Lou used to say. And she could sing, you know. I don't know if you ever heard her, but she could. I don't guess she was great, but she was good. The first time I saw her, she was singing in the lounge of the Marriott Hotel in Columbus, Ohio, that was. Or, another possibility, he hesitated, then went on in a lower voice. Prostitution is legal out there in Nevada, you know. Not in all of the counties, but in most of them. She could be working at one of them Green Lantern trailers there or the Mustang Ranch. Lots of women have got a streak of whore in them, and Lou was one. And I don't mean she stepped around on me or slept around on me. I don't mean that. So I can't say how I know, but I do. She could be in one of those places. He stopped, eyes distant, maybe imagining Lulu Bell on a bed in the back room of a Nevada trailer whorehouse. Lulu Bell wearing nothing but stockings, washing off some unknown cowboy's works, while from the other room came the sound of Steve Earle and the Dukes singing 6 Days on the Road, or a TV playing Hollywood Squares. Lulu Bell whoring, but not dead, the car by the side of the road, the little Subaru she had brought to the marriage, meaning nothing. The way an animal's look, so seemingly attentive, usually means nothing. I can believe it if I want, he said, swiping at his swollen eyes with the insides of his wrists. Sure, I said. You bet, LT. Wondering what the grinning men who listened to his story while they ate their lunches would make of this LT, this shaking man with his pale cheeks and red eyes and hot skin. Hell, he said, I do believe that. He hesitated, then said it again. I do believe that. When I got back, Rosalind was in bed with a book in her hand and the covers pulled up to her breasts. Holly had gone home while I was driving LT back to his house. Rosalind was in a bad mood, and I found out why soon enough. The woman behind the Mona Lisa smile had been quite taken with my friend, smitten by him maybe, and my wife most definitely did not approve. How did he lose his license, she asked, before I could answer. Drinking, wasn't it? Drinking, yes, OUI. I sat down on my side of the bed and slipped off my shoes, but that was nearly 6 months ago, and if he keeps his nose clean another 2 months, he gets it back. I think he will. He goes to AA, you know. My wife grunted, clearly not impressed. I took off my shirt, sniffed the armpits, and hung it back in the closet. I'd only worn it an hour or two, just for dinner. You know, my wife said, I think it's a wonder the police didn't look a little more closely at him when she disappeared. They asked him some questions, I said, but only to get as much information as they could. There was never any question of him doing it, Roz. There were never any suspicions of him. Oh, you're sure? As a matter of fact, I am. I know some stuff. Lulu Bell called her mother from a hotel in eastern Colorado the day she left, and called her again from Salt Lake City, Utah, the next day. She was fine then. Those were both weekdays, and LT was at the plant. He was at the plant the day they found her car parked off that ranch road near Caliente as well. Unless he can magically transport himself from place to place in the blink of an eye, he didn't kill her. Besides, he wouldn't. He loved her. She grunted. It's this hateful sound of skepticism she makes sometimes. After almost 30 years of marriage, that sound still makes me want to turn on her and yell at her to stop it, to shit or get off the pot, either say what she has on her mind or keep quiet. This time I thought about telling her how LT had cried, how it had been like there was a cyclone inside him, tearing loose everything that wasn't nailed down. I thought about it, but I didn't. Women don't trust tears from men. They may say different, but down deep, they do not trust tears from men. Maybe you ought to call the police yourself, I said. Offer them a little of your expert help. Point out the stuff they missed, just like Angela Lansbury on Murder, She Wrote. I swung my legs into bed. She turned off the light. We lay there in darkness. When she spoke again, her tone was gentler. I don't like him. That's all. I don't like him, and I never have. Yeah, I said, I guess that's clear. And I didn't like the way he looked at Holly. Which meant, of course, as I found out eventually, that she hadn't liked the way Holly had looked at him when she wasn't looking down at her plate, that was. "I'd prefer you didn't ask him back to dinner," she said. I kept quiet. It was late. I was tired. It had been a hard day, a harder evening, and I was tired. The last thing I wanted was to have an argument with my wife when I was tired and she was worried. That's the sort of argument where one of you ends up spending the night on the couch. And the only way to stop an argument like that is to be quiet. In a marriage, words are like rain. And the land of a marriage is filled with dry washes and arroyos that can become raging rivers in almost the wink of an eye. The therapists believe in talk, but most of them are either divorced or queer. It's silence which is a marriage's best friend. Silence. After a while, my best friend rolled over on her side, away from me and into the place where she goes when she finally gives up the day. I lay awake a little while longer, thinking of a dusty little car, perhaps once white, parked nose down in the ditch beside a ranch road out in the Nevada desert, not too far from Caliente. The driver's side door standing open. The rearview mirror torn off its post and lying on the floor. The front seat sodden with blood and tracked over by the animals that had come to investigate, perhaps to sample. There was a man, they assumed he was a man, it almost always is, who had butchered 5 women out in that part of the world, 5 in 3 years, mostly during the time LT had been living with Lulu Bell. 4 of the women were transients. He would get them to stop somehow, then pull them out of their cars, rape them, dismember them with an axe, leave them a rise or two away for the buzzards and the crows and the weasels. The 5th one was an elderly rancher's wife. The police call this killer the Axe Man. As I write this, the Axe Man has not been captured, nor has he killed again. If Cynthia Lulu Bell Sims DeWitt was the Axe Man's 6th victim, then she has been his last, at least so far. There is still some question, however, as to whether or not she was his 6th victim. If not in most minds, that question exists in the part of LT's mind, which is still allowed to hope. The blood on the seat wasn't human blood, you see. It didn't take the Nevada State Forensics Unit 5 hours to determine that. The ranch hand who found Lulu Bell's Subaru saw a cloud of circling birds half a mile away, and when he reached them, he found not a dismembered woman, but a dismembered dog. Little was left but bones and teeth. The predators and scavengers had had their day, and there's not much meat on a Jack Russell Terrier to begin with. The Axe Man most certainly got Frank. Lulu Bell's fate is probable, but far from certain. Perhaps, I thought, she is alive, singing Tie a Yellow Ribbon at the jailhouse in Ely, or Take a Message to Michael at the Rose of Santa Fe in Hawthorne, backed up by a 3-piece combo, old men trying to look young in red vests and black string ties. Or maybe she's blowing GM cowboys in Austin or Wendover, bending forward until her breasts press flat on her thighs beneath a calendar showing tulips in Holland, gripping set after set of flabby buttocks in her hands, and thinking about what to watch on TV that night when her shift is done. Perhaps she just pulled over to the side of the road and walked away. People do that. I know it. And you do, too. Sometimes people just say, fuck it, and walk away. Maybe she left Frank behind, thinking someone would come along and give him a good home, only it was the Axe Man who came along and... But no. No. I met Lulu Bell, and for the life of me, I can't see her leaving a dog to most likely roast to death or starve to death in the barrens, especially not a dog she loved the way she loved Frank. No. LT hadn't been exaggerating about that. I saw them together, and I know. She could still be alive somewhere, technically speaking at least. LT's right about that. Just because I can't think of a scenario that would lead from that car with the door hanging open and the rearview mirror lying on the floor and the dog lying dead and crow picked two rises away. Just because I can't think of a scenario that would lead from that place near Caliente to some other place where Lulu Bell Sims sings or sews or blows truckers safe and unknown, well, that doesn't mean that no such scenario exists. As I told LT, it isn't as though they found her body. They just found her car and the remains of the dog a little way from the car. Lulu Bell herself could be anywhere. You can see that. I couldn't sleep, and I felt thirsty. I got out of bed, went into the bathroom, and took the toothbrushes out of the glass we keep by the sink. I filled the glass with water. Then I sat down on the closed lid of the toilet and drank the water and thought about the sound that Siamese cats make, that weird crying, how it must sound good if you love them, how if you love them, it must sound like coming home. Thank you. I'll be back.
The Road Virus Heads North. Read by J.O. Sanders.
Richard Connell wasn't frightened when he first saw the picture at the yard sale in Rosewood. He was fascinated by it, and he felt he'd had the good luck to find something which might be very special. But fright? No. It didn't occur to him until later, not until it was too late, as he might have written in one of his own numbingly successful novels, that he had felt much the same way about certain illegal drugs as a young man. He had gone down to Boston to participate in a Penn New England conference titled The Threat of Popularity. You could count on Penn to come up with such subjects, Connell had found. It was actually sort of comforting. He drove the 260 miles from Derry rather than flying because he'd come to a plot impasse on his latest book and wanted some quiet time to try to work it out. At the conference, he sat on a panel where people who should have known better asked him where he got his ideas and if he ever scared himself. He left the city by way of the Tobin Bridge, then got on Route 1. He never took the turnpike when he was trying to work out problems. The turnpike lulled him into a state that was like dreamless waking sleep. It was restful, but not very creative. The stop-and-go traffic on the coast road, however, acted like grit inside an oyster. It created a fair amount of mental activity, and sometimes even a pearl. Not, he supposed, that his critics would use that word. In an issue of Esquire last year, Bradley Simons had begun his review of Nightmare City this way. Richard Connell, who writes like Jeffrey Dahmer cooks, has suffered a fresh bout of projectile vomiting. He has titled this most recent mass of ejecta Nightmare City. Route 1 took him through Revere, Malden, Everett, and up the coast to Newburyport. Beyond Newburyport and just south of the Massachusetts-New Hampshire border was the tiny little town of Rosewood. A mile or so beyond the town center, he saw an array of cheap-looking goods spread out on the lawn of a two-story cape. Propped against an avocado-colored electric stove was a sign reading Yard Sale. Cars were parked on both sides of the road, creating one of those bottlenecks which travelers unaffected by the yard sale mystique curse their way through. Connell liked yard sales, particularly the boxes of old books you sometimes found at them. He drove through the bottleneck, parked his Audi at the head of the line of cars pointed toward Maine and New Hampshire, then walked back. A dozen or so people were circulating on the littered front lawn of the blue and gray Cape Cod. A large television stood to the left of the cement walk, its feet planted on four paper ashtrays that were doing absolutely nothing to protect the lawn. On top was a sign reading, "Make an offer. You might be surprised." An electrical cord augmented by an extension trailed back from the TV and through the open front door. A fat woman sat in a lawn chair before it, shaded by an umbrella with Cinzano printed on the colorful scalloped flaps. There was a card table beside her with a cigar box, a pad of paper, and another hand-lettered sign on it. This sign read, "All sales cash, all sales final." The TV was on, tuned to an afternoon soap opera, where two beautiful young people looked on the verge of having deeply unsafe sex. The fat woman glanced at Cannell, then back at the TV. She looked at it for a moment, then looked back at him again. This time, her mouth was slightly sprung. "Ah," Cannell thought, looking around for the liquor box filled with paperbacks that was sure to be here someplace. "A fan." He didn't see any paperbacks, but he saw the picture, leaning against an ironing board and held in place by a couple of plastic laundry baskets, and his breath stopped in his throat. He wanted it at once. He walked over with a casualness that felt exaggerated and dropped to one knee in front of it. The painting was a watercolor, and technically very good. Cannell didn't care about that. Technique didn't interest him, a fact the critics of his own work had duly noted. What he liked in works of art was content, and the more unsettling, the better. This picture scored high in that department. He knelt between the two laundry baskets, which had been filled with a jumble of small appliances, and let his fingers slip over the glass facing of the picture. He glanced around briefly, looking for others like it, and saw none. Only the usual yard sale art collection of Little Bo Peeps, praying hands, and gambling dogs. He looked back at the framed watercolor, and in his mind he was already moving his suitcase into the back seat of the Audi so he could slip the picture comfortably into the trunk. It showed a young man behind the wheel of a muscle car, maybe a Grand Am, maybe a GTX, something with a T-top anyway, crossing the Tobin Bridge at sunset. The T-top was off, turning the black car into a half-assed convertible. The young man's left arm was cocked on the door, his right wrist was draped casually over the wheel. Behind him, the sky was a bruise-colored mass of yellows and grays, streaked with veins of pink. The young man had lank, blonde hair that spilled over his low forehead. He was grinning, and his parted lips revealed teeth which were not teeth at all, but fangs. "Or maybe they're filed to points," Cannell thought. "Maybe he's supposed to be a cannibal." He liked that. Liked the idea of a cannibal crossing the Tobin Bridge at sunset in a Grand Am. He knew what most of the audience at the Penn panel discussion would have thought. "Oh, yes, great picture for Rich Cannell. He probably wants it for inspiration. A feather to tickle his tired old gorge into one more fit of projectile vomiting." But most of those folks were ignoramuses, at least as far as his work went. And what was more, they treasured their ignorance, cosseted it, the way some people inexplicably treasured and cosseted those stupid, mean-spirited little dogs that yapped at visitors and sometimes bit the paperboy's ankles. He hadn't been attracted to this painting because he wrote horror stories. He wrote horror stories because he was attracted to things like this painting. His fans sent him stuff, pictures mostly, and he threw most of them away. Not because they were bad art, but because they were tiresome and predictable. One fan from Omaha had sent him a little ceramic sculpture of a screaming, horrified monkey's head poking out of a refrigerator door, however, and that one he had kept. It was unskillfully executed, but there was an unexpected juxtaposition there that lit up his dials. This painting had some of the same quality, but it was even better. Much better. As he was reaching for it, wanting to pick it up right now, this second, wanting to tuck it under his arm and proclaim his intentions, a voice spoke up behind him. "Aren't you Richard Canal?" He jumped, then turned. The fat woman was standing directly behind him, blotting out most of the immediate landscape. She had put on fresh lipstick before approaching, and now her mouth had been transformed into a bleeding grin. "Yes, I am," he said, smiling back. Her eyes dropped to the picture. "I should have known you'd go right to that," she said, simpering. "It's so you."
It is, isn't it?" he said, and smiled his best celebrity smile. "How much would you need for it?"
$45, she said. "I'll be honest with you, it started at 70, but nobody likes it, so now it's marked down. If you come back tomorrow, you can probably have it for 30.
The simper had grown to frightening proportions. Canell could see little gray spit buds in the dimples at the corners of her stretched mouth.
"I don't think I want to take that chance," he said. "I'll write you a check right now."
The simper continued to stretch. The woman now looked like some grotesque John Waters parody. Divine does Shirley Temple.
"I'm really not supposed to take checks, but all right," she said,
her tone that of a teenage girl finally consenting to have sex with her boyfriend.
"Only, while you have your pen out, could you write an autograph for my daughter? Her name is Robin."
"What a nice name," Canell said automatically.
He took the picture and followed the fat woman back to the card table. On the TV next to it, the lustful young people had been temporarily displaced by an elderly woman gobbling bran flakes.
"Robin reads all your books," the fat woman said. "Where in the world do you get all those crazy ideas?"
"I don't know," Canell said, smiling more widely than ever. "They just come to me. Isn't that amazing?"
The yard sale minder's name was Judy Diamond, and she lived in the house next door. When Canell asked her if she knew who the artist happened to be, she said she certainly did. Bobby Hastings had done it. And Bobby Hastings was the reason she was selling off the Hastings' things.
"That's the only painting he didn't burn," she said.
"Poor Iris, she's the one I really feel sorry for. I don't think George cared much, really. And I know he didn't understand why she wants to sell the house."
She rolled her eyes in her large, sweaty face, the old can-you-imagine-that look. She took Canell's check when he tore it off, then gave him the pad where she had written down all the items she'd sold and the prices she'd obtained for them.
"Just make it out to Robin," she said. "Pretty please with sugar on it?"
The simper reappeared like an old acquaintance you'd hoped was dead.
"Uh-huh,"
Canell said, and wrote his standard thanks for being a fan message. He didn't have to watch his hands or even think about it anymore, not after 25 years of writing autographs.
"Tell me about the picture and the Hastingses."
Judy Diamond folded her pudgy hands in the manner of a woman about to recite a favorite story.
"Bobby was just 23 when he killed himself this spring. Can you believe that?
He was the tortured genius type, you know, but still living at home."
Her eyes rolled, again asking Canell if he could imagine it.
"He must have had 70, 80 paintings, plus all his sketchbooks. Down in the basement they were."
She pointed her chin at the Cape Cod, then looked at the picture of the fiendish young man driving across the Tobin Bridge at sunset.
"Iris," that's Bobby's mother, "said most of them were real bad, lots worse than this. Stuff that'd curl your hair."
She lowered her voice to a whisper, glancing at a woman who was looking at the Hastings' mismatched silverware and a pretty good collection of old McDonald's plastic glasses in a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids motif.
"Most of them had sex stuff in them."
"Oh, no," Canell said.
"He did the worst ones after he got on drugs," Judy Diamond continued.
"After he was dead, he hung himself down in the basement where he used to paint.
They found over 100 of those little bottles they sell crack cocaine in."
"Aren't drugs awful, Mr. Canell?"
"They sure are.
Anyway, I guess he finally got to the end of his rope.
No pun intended.
He took all of his sketches and paintings out into the backyard, except for that one, I guess, and burned them. Then he hung himself down in the basement. He pinned a note to his shirt. It said, "I can't stand what's happening to me." Isn't that awful, Mr. Cannell? Isn't that just the horriblest thing you ever heard?
Yes, Cannell said sincerely enough. It just about is.
Like I say, I think George would go right on living in this house if he had his druthers, Judy Diamond said.
She took the sheet of paper with Robin's autograph on it, held it up next to Cannell's check, and shook her head, as if the similarity of the signatures amazed her.
But men are different.
Are they?
Oh, yes. Much less sensitive. By the end of his life, Bobby Hastings was just skin and bone, dirty all the time. You could smell him. And he wore the same T-shirt day in and day out. Had a picture of the Led Zeppelins on it. His eyes were red. He had a scraggle on his cheeks. You couldn't quite call a beard. And his pimples were coming back like he was a teenager again. But she loved him, because a mother's love sees past all those things.
The woman who had been looking at the silverware and glasses came over with a set of Star Wars placemats. Mrs. Diamond took $5 for them, wrote the sale carefully down on her pad below "One Does Assorted Potholders and Hot Pads," then turned back to Cannell.
"They went out to Arizona," she said, "to stay with Iris's folks. I know George is looking for work out there in Flagstaff. He's a draftsman, but I don't know if he's found any yet. If he has, I suppose we might not ever see them again here in Rosewood."
She marked out all the stuff she wanted me to sell, Iris did, and told me I could keep 20% for my trouble. I sent a check for the rest. "There won't be much." She sighed.
"The picture is great," Cannell said. "Yeah, too bad he burned the rest, because most of this other stuff's just standard yard sale crap. Pardon my French. What's that?"
Cannell had turned the picture around. There was a length of Dymotape pasted to the back.
"A title, I think. What's it say?"
He grabbed the picture by the sides and held it up so she could read it for herself. This put the picture at eye level to him, and he studied it eagerly, once again taken by the simple-minded weirdness of the subject. Kid behind the wheel of a muscle car. A kid with a nasty, knowing grin that revealed the filed points of an even nastier set of teeth. "It fits," he thought. "If ever a title fitted a painting, this one does." "The Road Virus Heads North," she read. "I never noticed that when my boys were lugging stuff out. Is it the title, you think?"
"Must be."
Cannell couldn't take his eyes off the blonde kid's grin. "I know something," the grin said. "I know something you never will."
"Well, I guess you'd have to believe the fellow who did this was high on drugs," she said, sounding upset.
Authentically upset, Cannell thought.
No wonder he could kill himself and break his mama's heart. "I gotta be heading north myself," Cannell said, tucking the picture under his arm. "Thanks for..." "Mr. Cannell?"
"Yes?"
"Can I see a driver's license?"
She apparently found nothing ironic or even amusing in this request.
"I ought to write the number on the back of your check."
Cannell put the picture down so he could dig for his wallet.
"Sure, you bet."
The woman who bought the Star Wars placemats had paused on her way back to her car to watch some of the soap opera playing on the lawn TV. Now she glanced at the picture which Cannell had propped against his shins.
"Ag," she said, "who'd want an ugly old thing like that? I'd think about it every time I turned the lights out."
"What's wrong with that?" Cannell asked. Cannell's Aunt Trudy lived in Wells, which is about 6 miles north of the Maine-New Hampshire border. Cannell pulled off at the exit which circled the bright green Wells water tower, the one with a comic sign on it, "Keep Maine Green, Bring Money," in letters 4 feet high,
and 5 minutes later he was turning into the driveway of her neat little saltbox house. No TV sinking into the lawn on paper ashtrays here. Only Aunt Trudy's amiable masses of flowers. Cannell needed to pee, and hadn't wanted to take care of that in a roadside rest stop when he could come here. But he also wanted an update on all the family gossip. Aunt Trudy retailed the best. She was to gossip what Zabar's is to Deli. Also, of course, he wanted to show her his new acquisition. She came out to meet him, gave him a hug, and covered his face with her patented little birdie kisses, the ones that had made him shiver all over as a kid.
"Want to see something?" he asked her. "It'll blow your pantyhose off."
"What a charming thought," Aunt Trudy said, clasping her elbows in her palms and looking at him with amusement. He opened the trunk and took out his new picture. It affected her all right, but not in the way he had expected. The color fell out of her face in a sheet. He had never seen anything quite like it in his entire life. "It's horrible," she said in a tight, controlled voice.
"I hate it. I suppose I can see what attracted you to it, Richie. But what you play at, it does for real. Put it back in your trunk like a good boy. And when you get to the Saco River, why don't you pull over into the breakdown lane and throw it in?"
He gaped at her. Aunt Trudy's lips were pressed tightly together to stop them from trembling, and now her long, thin hands were not just clasping her elbows, but clutching them, as if to keep her from flying away. At that moment, she looked not 61, but 91. "Auntie?" Cannell spoke tentatively, not sure what was going on here.
"Auntie, what's wrong?"
"That," she said, unlocking her right hand and pointing at the picture. "I'm surprised you don't feel it more strongly yourself, an imaginative guy like you." Well, he felt something. Obviously he had, or he never would have unlimbered his checkbook in the first place. Aunt Trudy was feeling something else, though. Or something more. He turned the picture around so he could see it. He had been holding it out for her so the side with the Dymatape title faced him, and looked at it again. What he saw hit him in the chest and belly like a 1-2 punch. The picture had changed. That was punch number one. Not much, but it had clearly changed. The young blonde man's smile was wider, revealing more of those filed cannibal teeth. His eyes were squinted down more, too, giving his face a look which was more knowing and nastier than ever. The degree of a smile, the vista of sharpened teeth widening slightly, the tilt and squint of the eyes, it's all pretty subjective stuff. A person could be mistaken about things like that, and of course he hadn't really studied the painting before buying it. Also, there had been the distraction of Mrs. Diamond, who could probably talk the cock off a brass monkey. But there was also punch number two, and that wasn't subjective. In the darkness of the Audi's trunk, the blonde young man had turned his left arm, the one cocked on the door, so that Cannell could now see a tattoo which had been hidden before. It was a vine-wrapped dagger with a bloody tip. Below it were words. Cannell could make out "death before," and he supposed you didn't have to be a big best-selling novelist to figure out the word that was still hidden. "Death before dishonor" was, after all, just the sort of thing a hoodoo traveling man like this was apt to have on his arm. And an ace of spades on the other one, Cannell thought.
"You hate it, don't you, Auntie?" he asked.
"Yes," she said. And now he saw an even more amazing thing. She had turned away from him, pretending to look out at the street, which was dozing and deserted in the hot afternoon sunlight, so she wouldn't have to look at the picture.
"In fact, Auntie loathes it. Now put it away and come on into the house. I'll bet you need to use the bathroom."
Aunt Trudy recovered her savoir-faire almost as soon as the watercolor was back in the trunk. They talked about Cannell's mother, Pasadena, his sister, Baton Rouge, and his ex-wife Sally, Nashua. Sally was a space case who ran an animal shelter out of a double-wide trailer and published 2 newsletters each month. Survivors was filled with astral info and supposedly true tales of the spirit world. Visitors contained the reports of people who'd had close encounters with space aliens. Cannell no longer went to fan conventions which specialized in fantasy and horror. One Sally in a lifetime, he thought, was enough. When Aunt Trudy walked him back out to the car, it was 4:30, and he'd turned down the obligatory dinner invitation. I can get most of the way back to Derry in daylight if I leave now.